Last month, the nation's first commercial tidal power project went into operation and started feeding electricity to the grid. Ocean Renewable Power Company eventually plans to install a total of 20 underwater turbines in the Gulf of Maine. Closer to home, the power of the tides is also at the heart of the town of Edgartown's plans for energy independence. Edgartown on Martha's Vineyard is hoping to be the first town in the nation to be energy independent, and key to that plan is a 5-megawatt underwater turbine tidal installation in Muskeget Channel. They're developing that in collaboration with the Marine Renewable Energy Center of New England and researchers at UMass Dartmouth and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Joining me now is John Miller, the director of the New England Renewable Energy Center. Welcome, John.
Good morning, Heather.
So how much energy does the ocean hold, and what are the different types of ocean energy that are out there?
Well, the primary sorts of ocean energy we look at are offshore wind, which, of course, is a big resource in this region, and wave and tidal. In addition to those, there's osmotic, which works on osmosis of salinity, salt content of the ocean, and there's ocean thermal, which is essentially is looking at putting a heat pump that takes advantage of the difference between temperature of very deep water and very warm equatorial surface water. Places like Hawaii could use that. So those are the big ones. The amount of energy is subject to a lot of different estimates. The most commonly used estimate for wave power is that there's something like 2 terawatts of energy in the ocean waves.
Terawatts don't mean a lot to me. What does that mean in terms of
essentially
what we're producing with fossil fuels now?
Essentially, what that says is that if you were able to convert that into electricity to reasonable efficiencies, you would have 6 to 8 times the total electrical usage of the world available in the oceans.
That's a lot of energy.
Yeah, it's a lot of energy. Tidal energy is somewhat less, but both of them benefit from the fact that they tend to be a little more predictable than other sorts. Wave energy is there most of the time, and it's predictable on the order of days, where wind is predictable on the order of within a day, so it has better predictability. Tidal energy obviously is predictable on the order of centuries. So if you're operating a grid, it's not just the amount of energy, but having it at the right time. So if you have sorts of energies like wave and tidal that are more predictable, more reliable, you can plug them in when you need it, and that allows you to turn down some of the carbon using sources.
So we're not just talking about some little boutique industry. This could actually be a major part of an energy portfolio of the future.
Absolutely. The current usage, the current potential estimates for New England are that there's enough energy in our ocean to completely meet the current electrical need of the region. That's about, that'd be 70 to 75% offshore wind, about 20% wave, and then a little bit from tidal. But again, the wave and tidal, while less, benefit from the predictability and reliability.
So what is standing in the way of taking advantage of all of this energy that's in the oceans all around us? Is it a technical or a knowledge issue? Is it a funding issue, a political issue?
Really, technology today. The current technologies, the ones that are closest to commercialization, are essentially technologies that came out of the 70s and were kind of put on the shelf after the energy crisis of the 70s. So they're newer technologies, second, third generation technologies, and that's what we're really looking for. The New England Marine Renewable Energy Center is dedicated to the development of ocean energy. But we're trying to help those second, third-generation technologies come through the development cycle. Doing something in the ocean is incredibly expensive. So we're trying to develop the test infrastructure, trying to coordinate the universities in the region to allow companies to bring those technologies to market more cost-effectively and more quickly.
So talk a little bit about the Marine Renewable Energy Center. I mean, is this it's a public-private, right? You're
right.
Part of UMass Dartmouth, but also in some way affiliated with the state government, is that correct?
Well, we're funded this year by the state government. We had federal funding. We've gotten great support from our congressional delegation. Congressman Delahunt was a big supporter. Congressman Frank McGovern, and currently Keating, is doing a great job of supporting us. But as you probably know, the federal budgets in this area are being cut, and so the state was good enough to step up and give us support for this year. They certainly see the potential, or again, for projects like the Edgartown project. And so they're supporting us. The center is a center within the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth but it's under economic development, not under an academic center. So we're focused on trying to develop this energy or these energy sources across the region.
Now, I've read that the cost, when you take into account all of the pre-construction surveys that you have to do and the construction costs and the technology costs, currently the cost of producing, say, tidal energy offshore is like 6 to 7 times the cost of producing, say, wind energy on land. But obviously, somebody thinks that this is financially viable. There is now a commercial installation in Maine that started feeding power to the grid last month. So how are they making ends meet?
Well, currently it is a tough sell. The cost of tidal or wave energy is probably 2 to 3 times onshore wind. By the end of this, within the next couple of years, those that are closest to commercialization hope to be competitive with offshore wind. So that's their current goal. But the costs are coming down. Like any other new industry, it's a matter of developing and getting enough into production so that you can bring those costs down. There certainly are special challenges of doing things in the ocean because you want to do it in a sustainable manner so you don't impact the environment. But you also have a very tough environment to survive in.
We're talking about ocean energy today, how much there is, where it comes from, and how we can begin to harness it. If you have questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-999-4626 or email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. We're also on Twitter as Living Lab Radio. And I'm joined now by a couple of researchers also working on this project. Anthony Karincic, an assistant scientist at the Physical Oceanography Department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Welcome to you.
Hi, thank you, Heather.
And Brian Howes, professor and director of the Coastal Systems Program at UMass Dartmouth.
Happy to be here.
Now, Brian, your research is really diverse, doesn't even quite cover it. You've been doing a lot of actually, and people may have heard your name in connection with a lot of the water quality work that's been going on around the Cape for a decade or more. Where does research on ocean energy fit into the picture for you?
It ends up that many of the tools that we use in our restoration of estuarine environments, lakes and things like that, also are used for siting and for predicting the impacts of renewable energy. Really what we do as an overarching goal is try to understand the impacts of different man-made activities on the environment. How this fits in, though, to renewable energy is that when you talked about cost, a lot of the cost is of determining the siting and getting the permitting done. And so a lot of what we have done, including the work in Maine, that first project, we worked with ORPC in their siting decisions up there years ago when they were in their piloting phase. Now we're working with the Marine Renewable Energy Center to work on Muskeget and also the wave energy pilot off of Nantucket. Those issues revolve around a simple fact that if you want to get a permit, you have to be able to determine if the technology you put in the water is going to affect the things in a negative fashion. And underwater turbines, even wave devices, have sound effects, meaning on whales, potentially on seal, pinheads, seals, things like that. So we have to deal with that. They can affect fish larvae, potentially. They can affect the structure of the marine community, potentially. All of those things. If we have to do the level of work we're doing in Muskeget for every tidal energy project and everything we put in the water in the United States around the world, it will be cost prohibitive. So our research is to come up with what you have to do, how to streamline how you do it. And this is actually one of the things that we're working with Woods Hole Oceanographic on is new technologies for measuring the impacts so we can get those costs way down so we can reduce the costs of using this technology in the marine environment by cutting the costs of determining environmental impacts. We're not going to support things that are going to affect the environment in a negative way. But right now, no one really knows. And I've been working with a biology department scientist here, Craig Taylor, on fish larvae impacts, for instance, of underwater turbines. People worry about that. And also on the wave energy project, we have coastal shelf fisheries and things like that impacts. Right now, we haven't been finding impacts, not the same kinds of impacts that you find from other types of technologies, but we're not completely done yet either.
So is the hope, you know, you're talking about streamlining the process, is the hope that some of what you learn in terms of the actual impacts, that could be extrapolated to other sites or, yeah, you know, in terms of perhaps this type of underwater turbine kills this number of fish per hour or something like that.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, the basic thing is that people want to know, and people have challenged us and said, well, we won't let you do this until you can show that it doesn't have an effect. And we say, well, great. There's never been one put in the water before. How can we predict that impact? So one of the missions of John as director of MREC has been to try to get pilot projects in the water. And in Muskeget, there have been two. The first tidal turbine pilot in Massachusetts was deployed in Muskeget Channel 2 summers ago. We had another pilot project last year. We have a wave project going in off of Nantucket. When those are in the water, then we can actually determine their effect directly rather than through just theoretical means. Once we have that, then we know this technology affects this type of thing. And so, and it doesn't have any effect on these other types of things. So maybe in other places that want to deploy it will either not be forced to look at those other things, or we'll have to just do a very, like a just a quick test to see if that's an effect.
Now, Anthony, you study coastal currents, the movement of coastal waters as a physical oceanographer, and you've been very involved in developing technologies and testing technologies for that. Correct. In terms of the technologies that you're developing or testing to look at ocean energy projects, is that also helping you learn something basic about how the ocean works?
Absolutely, it is. One of the primary tools I use in my research is a coastal radar, and we have a number of systems set up around Martha's Vineyard, and we're moving one to Nantucket as part of the project there. And this instrument measures primarily surface currents remotely over a broad area offshore where the antennas are on land. But one of the future research projects that we hope to do is to fine-tune the way to measure wind and waves remotely. And so someone who wanted to know the wave field offshore without putting a buoy out there could use these systems that exist all around the country to do so, and also the same with the wind field. And so there's some immediate benefits for offshore energy development, but then also my own research. I would love to know the spatial dependence of the wind field and how it affects a cross-shelf exchange types of research projects that I work on.
So one thing I've always wondered, when you harness the energy of the waves or the tides, do you end up changing how much energy is left in the system? Do you change how hard the waves hit the beach if you've already captured some of that energy for wave energy? Do you change how fast the tides are flowing, that kind of thing?
I think you obviously do. The big question is how much? And is it something that you can actually measure with the instruments that myself and Brian use, or is it something that's kind of within the noise of our instruments right now? And I think that's one of the questions that will come out of both the experiment off Nantucket and then a potential turbine installation in the channel, is how much can we measure the difference? Does it have a profound effect on the sediment transport around the channel or the biological systems that Brian mentioned? And so that's one of the reasons to get these things in the water and as at a pilot type of stage, and to look at them is to see how big are the effects actually. I mean, we have some numerical models that have shown that the effects are relatively small, but let's go and test that to make sure.
Now, I want to talk about the Muskeget Channel tidal project a little bit more specifically. This is a project, as I understand, that the town of Edgartown basically came up with this idea that they wanted to be energy independent and they would like to try tidal. They thought that could be a major part of it, but that, again, the cost was so high, there was no way as a town they were going to be able to do that on their own. So they approached the Marine Renewable Energy Center. Is that correct, John?
That's correct. It is very expensive, as Brian was mentioning, to do the studies, especially the first people in the water with these devices have to essentially prove all the potential negative impacts aren't there. And so it is very expensive. Edgartown, the way the process works in the United States for tidal is it's a first-come, first-serve process. So companies went out and tried to tie up all the potential sites for tidal energy. Tidal energy that's being harnessed now is dependent upon the velocity of the flow. So you need something on the order of 4 knots velocity to be able to harness it cost-effectively. So Edgartown was one of the places that was identified. A company put in an application to have the right to develop that technology or develop that resource. And Edgartown used a municipal preference to take that away from them.
So if towns want to or counties want to use their offshore waters, their resources, they have preference over any company that wants
right,
to do it?
Exactly. But no one else has done that. So Edgartown is essentially the only one in the country that's doing this as a municipality. And they did not have the funding to do all of the studies. So we've been helping them find the money to do the studies and doing the studies for them.
So where do you find that money?
We were helped a lot by our congressional delegation. Congressman Delahunt got us a couple of earmarks to help us do that. And then more recently, again, the state has stepped up and is funding specific projects to answer specific questions.
So then that state funding is presumably not trickling down, but being funneled to Brian and Anthony, researchers like yourselves, to do this necessary research. From your point of view, is this, I don't want to say easy money exactly, but you're not having to write grants yourselves to get this, right? So is this something that kind of is a boost to your labs and your research projects?
Well, the first thing is that whereas the money we get from the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, we do have to write grants for. We also have competitive grants. And one of the things that Anthony's group and my group and a few others, a number of others are working on is a NOAA technology project. So there are a variety of competitive grants. The earmarks are particularly useful early on, and they are for many technologies early on because there's frequently not any other means to get the money for a municipality. This is to support a municipal effort to do a proof of concept. Early on, that was very useful. As the system matures, then we hope to see that private industry step in a little bit more and some more competitive type granting. But I think that we're running a significant amount right now. We've evolved from earmarks into competitive granting at this point. Without it, though, I talked to one of the wave energy generators, and they said that who is very successful, probably the top wave energy generator in the country, and and their statement was that without early infusions, just early infusions of a little bit of money, that they never would have gotten off the ground.
Well, and you say the top wave energy generator in the country, but do we actually have any commercial wave energy installations running? My understanding was that there's one permitted off the coast of Oregon, but none actually producing electricity yet.
They have developed wave energy generators for other uses other than municipal and on the grid. They have on the grid things, which we're hoping to pilot, but they also have other uses of that money, moorings, harbor protection, coastal protection, things like that, where you need remote energy. And that's a lot of what this will be used for in the United States is probably remote energy generation.
Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. Joel, what's on your mind?
Hi. I remember some years back mention being made that some test turbines are being put in Cape Cod Canal. I've never heard anything about it since. I was wondering whether you had any feedback on the results of those trials. And I'm also curious about whether the tidal energy extraction would be strictly from current flow, or whether there's going to be some lame brain ideas about damming tidal basins, like somebody wanted to dam up the Fundy Bay. There go the 50-foot tides up at the head of the bay, and there goes all the resonance for the entire Gulf of Maine and Bay of Fundy and Massachusetts Bay and Cape Cod Bay would be completely screwed up. I was wondering.
All right, Joel. Thanks for your questions, John. What happened to the project in the canal?
Two great questions. Two things in the canal. One, there was a demonstration done by a professor named Gorloff from Northeastern, and he demonstrated his tidal device in the canal for a short period of time. When the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission started accepting applications for tidal energy, a company got the rights to develop the Cape Cod Canal. That's done by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It doesn't; they don't necessarily get permission from the Corps of Engineers to do that, the Corps of Engineers that owns the canal. The Corps of Engineers would not allow anyone to put a device in the canal because there just isn't enough room. There's enough room for navigation. The second question
was whether these are going to be underwater flow-based technologies, or whether we're looking at dams, large structures that block off waterways.
There is a technology called barrage, which essentially is a dam on a tidal estuary. There are two that have been in operation for 20 to 30 years, one in Annapolis, Canada, and one in France. They're very effective. They're, again, just like hydroelectric dams. They do have a big impact on the estuary behind that dam because they cut down the exchange of water, et cetera, in that area. So they're not something that they'd ever think about using in the United States, but they have built a big one recently in Korea. So they are used, they are effective, but not something people want to do in the United States.
I mean, that's not what we're looking at here. No. What do these... What does it look like? What we're talking about putting in the water in Muskeget Channel, what does that actually look like?
The current technologies are all what we call in-stream. So they depend on the velocity of the water. So again, you need 4 knots or better to be cost-effective. The ones that are on the grid right now are essentially something that looks like a wind turbine, but obviously downsized because of the water is 800 times more dense than air. So they have to be, the blades are smaller and more robust. There are some other technologies that look at doing this in a little different way. And again, those are the newer technologies we'd like to look at to see if they could be more cost effective.
Now, when you've got something, it's not a dam, it's like a wind turbine underwater. As you said, it's basically out of sight, out of mind. And I wonder if this Muskeget Channel project, or in general, if you have a sense of whether ocean energy, at least in the underwater forms, the tidal or the wave, attract the same sort of very strong public sentiment that some other, say, Cape Wind or other wind energy projects have.
Well, I mean, the problem with any sort of energy project is it tends to be large scale, and so someone's going to be impacted. If you put something on the bottom of the ocean, someone's going to be impacted, if only a recreational fisherman. You have to be sensitive and listen to all of the people that may be impacted. Tidal energy is relatively low impact for a couple of reasons. One, it tends to be in areas where the velocity is very high. And so far, all the studies suggest that fish and seals don't necessarily want to hang out in those areas. So the direct impact of strikes just isn't there. It is under the water, so people don't see it. It doesn't impact people's vision of the water. And it tends to be, again, the blades turn relatively slowly compared with wind turbines. These blades turn at something like 10 revolutions per minute. So fish and animals that are in the area are able to avoid them. And if they are impacted, which to date there really have not been any impacts, the impact is going to be minimal.
Now, Anthony, you mentioned that some people who, obviously we have huge coastal erosion problems here on the Cape and Islands, and you mentioned that some people who are very sensitive to that issue are a little concerned about the possible impacts of wave or tidal installations. What's the issue there? What's the concern?
I think that goes back to the project that we're starting up on Nantucket at Mattock Beach, and that's a site of very heavy erosion, just from the environmental factors that are going on the island. And I think there were a couple of failed projects in the past to control the erosion in the area, and so that the local residents are pretty wary, rightly so, of any project coming in that has something to do with energy and changing the wave energy that's out there. And so we had a public meeting over the summer that talked about the radar system that we were going to put up at the beach, and then the demonstration project that was going to go in the water now next spring, I think. And there was a number of concerns about, like, well, how much is the impact going to be? You know, will we be able to see it? How long will you be there? Is this the harbinger for something that was much, much larger that's going to come? And none of that was really the case. As John described earlier, this is a one-time demonstration of a relatively small paddle that I think it'll likely be difficult to measure any change on erosional aspects on the beach from this device itself. And so that was part of the issue, and it was a good conversation to have, because I think we were able to describe the actual experiment that was going to take place and then the potential impact that would have from that experiment. So,
now, the Marine Renewable Energy Center has its annual technical conference coming up next week, I understand. What's on tap there?
Yeah, the 30th and 31st, we have our technical conference in Rhode Island and Providence. It's going to be about 40 papers plus some speakers from around the world. We have the CEO of one of the major tidal companies in the world, a tidal company that's interesting because they don't have just one device. They've developed different devices for different environments. And so he's going to come talk about how they have tried to develop products to meet the market, if you will. We have Robin Wallace, who's head of the SuperGen, which is a big research consortium for marine energy in the UK. and he's going to come talk about what's going on in the rest of the world. So we have some great speakers coming. We have, again, a 40 or so papers being presented, including Anthony, I think, is presenting, and Brian has someone from his group that's presenting. So it's a great exchange.
This is open to the public?
Yes, absolutely. Some of the presentations can get a little technical, but for the most part, sitting through them is interesting. You get to see what people are studying, what the issues are, and how people are trying to address those issues.
Now, I can't let you guys all go without asking. We've got presidential elections coming up in a few weeks. Is that on your radar? Is that something has you concerned or excited? What do you see potentially as the impact on ocean energy of either a second term for President Obama or a first term for a potential President Mitt Romney?
Generally speaking, the things we're hearing from Washington are that both parties are concerned about the budget deficit, and that certainly budgets aren't going to go up. They're going to go down no matter who's president, and that we've got to figure out how to be very effective and efficient in the money we do get. I mean, one of the things we've done very, very well here is to try and get multiple benefits out of the things we do. When we do a demonstration of a tidal device in Muskega Channel, Brian's doing his work. We had people from the National Renewable Energy Lab coming out and testing instrumentation. We had people from New Hampshire doing studies here. So we try to get as much as we can out of what we're doing. And so we'll think we'll be okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much all for being here. John Miller is the director of the New England Marine Renewable Energy Center. Anthony Karincich is an assistant scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And Brian Howes is professor and director of the Coastal Systems Program at UMass Dartmouth. Thank you all again for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can find a link to more information about the Muskeget Channel Tidal Power Project and about the Marine Renewable Energy Center's annual technical conference on our website. Go to capeandislands.org and click on Living Lab. This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on The Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Tridle and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. Living Lab on The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.